Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax. Thank you so much for coming out tonight, and thank you for supporting independent bookstores and our author events here at the Tattered Cover. Well, I've been looking forward to meeting Jonathan Evason ever since I read an interview with Powell's Bookstore about his first novel, the award-winning All About Lulu. When he said he liked reading, writing, and drinking beer, I knew he was my kind of person. And when he talked about his quirky, well, actually more than quirky, even more quirky than mine, relatives, I thought, yes, this book's going to be great. And west of here was also worth the wait. I think the way one of our fellow booksellers from the Gallery Bookshop in Mendocino described west of here is the best way I've read to describe it. Christy Olson Day said, "I love this big, gorgeous novel in which characters and storylines flow, merge, and diverge like streams and channels of a river. The story spans more than 100 years in a fictional town of Port Bonita, Washington, and its surrounding wilderness. Evason pulls together such grand themes as relationship to the land, what we make of our past, and what we owe the future. His writing style is unpretentious and delightful, a combination of big ideas, down-to-earth, friendly delivery that's perfectly suited to this quintessential American novel." Jonathan Evason lives on an island in western Washington with his family, and in his teens, he was the founding member and frontman of the Seattle punk band March of Crimes, which included future members of Pearl Jam and Soundgarden. So I'm going to give him all the time this evening. Please welcome Jonathan Evason.
Well, thank you all for coming. And I just have to say thank you to Tattered Cover in a really, really big way. Jackie and Lisa and Kathy in particular have been really, really behind my book in a region that's not my own. And, because of you guys, it's like, I mean, you've really given my book legs in like a 5-state area. It's amazing what independent booksellers can do. And I've been the beneficiary of a lot of independent bookseller love, and thank you for that. I don't really know where I'm going. I never do. This is my 13th event in 14 nights. I haven't been sleeping a lot. I visited the neighborhood Irish bar for about 3 hours before I came here, but I think I'm still okay. If you want to interrupt me at any point with a question, please do, and know that I'm very candid. My favorite part of these events is just sort of the give and take. I imagine maybe some of you have read it and some of you haven't, but when we get to the Q&A, anything, you know, craft stuff, professional stuff, industry stuff, stuff about the book, anything, I love to talk about it, because the reason I write books is to start cultural conversations. I mean, for me, that's the purpose of all art. And recently, I've been the beneficiary of a lot of great reviews, but I've also been the beneficiary of some scathing hatchet jobs, and I'm actually really happy about that. As weird as that sounds, it's a sort of a convenient defense mechanism, but also because there wouldn't be any conversation without that. So people think it's, I'm on like a 28 city and 31 day type of tour here, and people go, "Well, God, that must be just so exhausting, and that seems like so different from you know, just sitting in your sweatpants and writing a book." And it is, but it isn't, because of the conversation. You know what I mean? I unleash this thing in the world and try to share it with the reader, and after that, it becomes all about the conversation. So this, for me, is just an extension. I'm losing my voice a little bit, and I apologize. That's because I like to talk to you. So I'll probably end up reading a little bit, but maybe I'll just tell you a little bit about the book first, maybe read a couple of sections, and then we can just, you know, have that conversation. How many people have read the book? Maybe that'll just help me to... Okay, good. So that tells me I have to be really careful about spoilers, because I'm not very good. Once I get going, I kind of get going, so I don't want to spoil anything. And it'll also, in 13 days, I have not read the same passage twice. What is this money doing in my book? Whose money is this?
My bartender.
Really, dude? I told you I had that. I'll get the... I guess I'm reading this page tonight. So, my first novel was it was a coming of age tale, first person kind of voice narrative, family drama comedy. I don't want to say standard fare, but like a really good entree for an author into the world. People, I the reading public tends to like this sort of first person coming of age sort of, I got a lot of Salinger comparisons and so forth. So for my second novel, which, and I should also tell you, my second novel is like my ninth novel. Before I ever published Lulu, I wrote six novels and countless short stories. And I actually physically dug a hole and buried three of my novels, salted the earth, so nothing would ever grow there again. So if there's any writers, I can tell you where, but they've decomposed by now. I mean, it's been a lot of years. Two of them I buried in Washington, in the woods behind my house in Suquamish, and one of them I buried in a senior citizen motorhome park that I was living in. I was the only person under 65 living at this motorhome park because I was taking care of my agoraphobic grandmother, and I buried that one there. And it was very cathartic because I knew they weren't very good. You know what I mean? Before I finished them, I knew they were failures. But I felt lucky to have written them. But I just needed to bury them. I didn't need them haunting me. So, sorry, I digress a lot. Especially after living at the Irish Bar for 3 hours. So when my second novel, when I got ready to write West of Here, and the first novel had been very well received, I knew that I really, really wanted to push myself on someplace uncomfortable. As an artist, that's what I want to do, is I want to challenge myself, and I want to throw myself at the work, and I want to have to use every tool I've developed, and like a lot of tools I haven't had, because I want to develop them. One of the great things about being a writer is that I'm 43 and I feel really old, and I have a enlarged prostate and a bad back, but like everyone still calls me a young writer, and it's like, yes! You know what I mean? I was talking to Keith Hernandez's daughter today, and I was like, if I were a baseball player, even a Hall of Famer, I would have retired 3 years ago. And here I'm 3 years old in the novelist's life. I don't even know where that started, but I'm really grateful to be doing the work. Oh, right. I'm pushing myself. So I came up with this idea to write not a historical novel, but a novel about history. And there's actually a really big difference. Especially when you get down to the research, it's really sort of daunting. But I envisioned this work that was a conversation between two epics. I wanted to tell the history of one small town, but I didn't want to tell a linear history. I didn't want to like start in 1889 and just sort of go through and end up in 2006. And I didn't even want to cover everything in between. I looked at it as a sort of causal relationship. I wanted to capture this sort of 19th century Emersonian mindset, this manifest destiny, this real strong sense of entitled personal destiny. And I wanted to show the results, sort of cause and effect. And in doing so, I didn't really want to. I didn't want to be too hard on the 19th century, because I feel like it's really easy to say, "Boy, we really fucked this up." You know, I mean, like, you know, we misused our resources. We had our blinders on. We were so tied up in our personal destiny that we didn't think ahead enough. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And you know, that's why I bifurcated the novel into these two timelines to show that effect. But at the same time, I feel like I don't want to be too hard on the 19th century, because it was a pretty amazing idea. You know, I mean, Manifest Destiny was a pretty cool idea. Maybe not all of it, but the idea, I mean, at the very least, the idea of just totally leveling the classes, and for the first time really in recorded human history, having a culture where anybody with a shovel and an axe could go homestead 140 acres and prove up on it and create a future for themselves. That was a very new idea. And when you couldn't see the end of the resources, you know, it's kind of hard to blame them in a way. It's a lot easier with hindsight. I'm really rambling here. Sorry. This is maybe my most rambling intro ever. Yeah, well, maybe I should just read. But which brings me to my next point. I've never read the same thing twice out of this book because I can't figure out how to do it, because everything is about connective tissue. Even though there's this separation of 125 years, every character is connected to every other character in a number of different ways, genealogically, mostly place, sometimes occupationally, but like there's a lot of connective tissue. So I find that when I read stuff aloud, I have to stop like on the second sentence and go, well, you ought to know that Jared is the relative of, you know, and so we'll see how that goes. Maybe I'll try something completely different tonight and read. I found more money in my book. Whose is this? No, really, somebody's welcome. I've got an extra 18 bucks here. Happy hour's over. That ought to buy at least, you know, a good pour of Jameson and a couple of Guinness. All right, I'm just going to read some stuff, sort of randomly. My one itinerary will be that I'm going to try to read some stuff from both epics, so you kind of get an idea. The novel sort of has a couple of different tones. Okay, maybe I'll start with something very, very manifest destiny. When Ethan Thornburg comes to this town of Port Bonita, which is based on the town of Port Angeles in Washington, he comes trying to win back his pregnant lover, who is they're not married, and she is of the Helen Hunt Jackson persuasion. Very, she wants to be a journalist, and she's what they called in the 1880s a new woman, and she's very, I mean, she's the proto-feminist, basically. And Ethan is a failed accountant who comes to try to win her back and doesn't know really what he wants to do, but ultimately realizes that his destiny is to dam really one of the greatest rivers in the West. I mean, the Elwha River was the greatest salmon run in the history of the world. I'm already spoiling stuff, by the way. Read the book still, or at least buy it. this is called Greasing the Wheels, April 1890. So give you a kind of a flavor of the sort of Victorian voice of the first part of the novel. Six dozen strong, eager men with appetites, 20 and 30 and 50 years old, gnashing their teeth, shouting themselves hoarse as they carved and hammered and blasted the canyon to dust for weeks on end. 12 and 14 hours a day, inch by inch, they did the impossible. They moved the river. From the vantage of the riprap bank, standing astride boulders, Ethan watched his destiny unfold, watched as load after load of gravel came down the mountain by flat car to fill the breach, saw it dumped in the river by the ton, until at last, on a crisp, clear afternoon in early spring, flanked by a foreman and engineers, Ethan watched the debris break the waterline, and he felt his heart thrill as the river began to back up into the diversion channels, creeping toward the floodplain. And still, Ethan was restless. Still he yearned for the dam itself, yearned to see its concrete bulk rising from the canyon floor, yearned to feel the surge of the giant penstocks as they inhaled the river, its turbines churning water into luminous dreams. It wasn't enough to divert the river or even stop it in its course. Ethan longed to see the power of the river transformed, longed to see its wild essence burning incandescent in sitting rooms and stations from Moore Stock to the East End. And what to fuel these dreams of incandescence, if not the sweat of Port Bonitans? And at what cost were dams and nations built? Money. Money for manpower and the infrastructure to support it. Money for titles and acquisitions, and money to grease the wheels of fortune. Money for rails and rolling stock. Money to grade inroads and clear timber. Money to turn mountains into dust. Monies for the great barge-mounted dredges soon to arrive from Seattle. Money for concrete and the power to mix and move it. Every steel cable crisscrossing the canyon, every heavy-headed maul hammering the earth, cost hard currency. And the money flowed, arriving invisibly from Chicago to fuel the beast, but never without strings, always burdened by demands and unreasonable expectations. Still, the money came without fail, and Ethan put it to work. And who to keep this revenue streaming but a man of Jacob's distinction, a Lambert, and by his very birthright a captain of industry? Who better to see the big picture than a man from the East? Like brothers, they quarreled in the dusty light of the office, to the ceaseless accompaniment of blasting, like distant mortar fire. Don't be naive, Ethan. You can hardly expect them to provide the capital and not gain by it. They're not a bank, they're shareholders. They're investors, Jake. Precisely. We are the investment. Jacob laughed. I see. Is that how you see it? I rather think that the shareholders are under the impression that a hydroelectric dam is the investment, Ethan. Or to put it more precisely, the power that dam will one day generate. They'll get their share, grumbled Ethan. That's what they paid for. But no more, I tell you. I don't intend to let them steamroll the interests of this town. Without this town, there would be nothing to invest in. The town will benefit from the power, Ethan. That is the point, is it not? And what of the profit, Jake? Who will benefit from that? Okay, so all very 19th century, personal destiny, industry, money from the East developing in the West, a familiar story, which is one of the reasons I chose Port Angeles, which is Port Bonita, is because it provided a really great microcosm for the American story. Everything you can say about the development of the West is all wrapped up in this little town. The book is composed of something like 4 dozen limited points of view. About wanting to write a novel about history, but not a historical novel, was that so often historical texts use a wide-angle lens, you know? I envisioned a lens that was more like a kaleidoscope that was built of these clashing and overlapping and spinning limited points of view, made up of people and donkeys and, I mean, just like everything that built it. And it sounds like it would make a confusing read, but what happened is as I wrote the book, is that in spite of any like ambitious formal construction I devised, the characters and the land really just took over. Everything is really grounded, and so far nobody's really had any trouble tracking the characters. So in that chapter, I talked about the dam, so I thought maybe I'll talk about the dam again in the 19th century, and I'm looking for a place. It just occurred to me that maybe I'll... when I told you Eva was pregnant, Eva is who Ethan came to... That was the woman he came to win over. She was pregnant. Eventually, she has Eva, and she's very conflicted about being a mother and about motherhood. And like, as I say, she's like this proto-feminist, and like, she's really there, and she's like finally sort of making inroads to her journalistic career. And she's writing a big story. This is so many spoilers. Damn it. This is impossible. I'm sorry. You should have all read this before you came. It's your fault. I'm giving away the whole novel. Fuck it. Good thing this was in Salt Lake City. Okay. So anyway, I found it, I think. Here's the construction of the dam, but from Ethan's newborn child's perspective. This is called Chill Waters, September 1890. The baby is a girl, and her name is Minerva. Another spoiler. This is so frustrating. Ugh. Sorry. Minerva came to know the caress of rough hands and the deafening crack of mortar blasts from dawn until dusk. She came to know the yellow light of late summer slanting through the window and how the dust turned somersaults in its radiance. She slept always with the orange pulse of candlelight behind her eyelids and the soft murmur of gruff voices beneath her dreams. And she slept well. And each time she woke, it was as though she had done so for the first time. And the newness of life was a thing to crawl up inside of, a thing to savor on her tongue, a thing to grasp with chubby fingers at every opportunity and not let go. She came to know a sea of voices and a sea of faces and a thousand different smells, from the sweet spice of rough-hewn cedar to the chalky itch of basalt dust. And her favorite smell of all would become the acrid odor of her father's neck, her favorite touch his calloused hand. There were days in the waning summer and early autumn when he took her far from the clatter of the canyon to the chill waters upstream, where she lolled on the riverbank beneath his delicious gaze, sharing it with no one as she watched the endless stream of silver fish fighting their way upriver as though their lives depended on it, little knowing that they did. The silver fish were a miracle in the sunlight, a river running inside of the river, a leaping, wriggling ribbon of life. And it felt to the child as though the whole world existed in the shade of an alder on the bank of a river beneath the gaze of her father. Okay, so that's her perspective. Don't know where to go. Somewhere modern. I mean, I think you're kind of getting the idea. They came, they saw, they conquered. And 150 years later, there's not much left. How does a blind date sound to everybody? Franklin Bell is like the only black guy in Port Bonita. It's a rural town. I spent a lot of time in Port Angeles, and I actually haven't seen a black guy there yet. But for the sake of my novel, I made there be one. If I can find it. I don't know how this is going to work, but you can tell me. And if it gets boring at any point, somebody just... And then we could just talk. Deal Breaker, July 2006. Really, tell me when it starts to get boring because we can talk. As I said, I think the book reads nicely, but like reading it aloud and not spoiling stuff is a kind of a challenge. July 2006. See, I haven't started and I already have to explain something. Hillary is sort of the... not exactly an analog, but very much a modern parallel to Eva, who is the proto-feminist. Hillary, God, I can't even say that. I can't say it. Never mind. I can't. No, but no. Seriously, I'm spoiling some of the few dramatic events in the book. So, just know that it's a blind date. With a woman who's a little sexually conflicted, whose mother is always trying to pressure her into dating other guys. And let's leave it at that. That's probably giving up too much. Hillary had planned on ordering a single glass of house red and nursing it through the evening. But by the time she parked the Silverado, wobbled across the gravel lot in high heels, and stepped through the double doors of the Bushwhacker, her nerves were already getting the best of her. She knew immediately that all bets were off. She was wringing her hands under the table when Molly, the waitress, arrived for the orders. "I'll have a gin and tonic," she said. "Y'all got eggnog?" Franklin said. Molly arched an incredulous brow. "In like 4 months we might." "Just give me a glass of milk then." He was older than Hillary expected. She hadn't expected salt and pepper. And blacker, too. Not that there was anything wrong with that. Strange that Jeannie had failed to mention it, though, since there were only about 3 black people in Port Bonita. "Nice place," she said. Franklin surveyed the Bushwhacker. Something smelled like fish. "Yeah," he said, "not bad." She was younger than Franklin expected. A little chunkier, too, but in all the right places. Still, Franklin couldn't seem to muster his characteristic exuberance. I gotta stop and tell you that Franklin is a parole officer and that he's just lost. He had a string of like 317 parolees in a row where he where he delivered, turned these guys around. Nobody was a repeat offender, and he's just lost his first. So when I refer to Tim in here, see, this is the problem. Every chapter is like this. This is a pain in my ass. Still, Franklin couldn't seem to muster his characteristic exuberance. The loss of Tim and Tillman was still nagging him. He'd forgotten how much he hated losing them. It wasn't even about facilitating anymore. The knowledge that some tattooed knucklehead was out fixing leaky radiators instead of marking time was not the payoff. The payoff was the knowledge that Franklin was good at what he did, that he packed his lunch and got the job done. 317 consecutive times he'd gotten the job done before Tim and Tillman walked to his door. How had he miscalculated? "You seem down," Hillary observed, hitching up her blouse. "It's me. You're disappointed." "No, no, far from that," he said. "It's work." "Jeannie said you're a parole officer?" "I guess I didn't need to tell you that." "That's right. That must be interesting." "Yeah, well, don't know about that. Suppose someone's got to do it." The drinks arrived. Franklin wasted little time in getting started on his milk. "So then, you must believe in second chances," said Hillary. "Suppose I do, now that you put it that way." "What about third chances?" "Depends." Franklin wrinkled his face and set his glass down. He had a milk mustache. "This tastes sour to you?" He slid the milk across the table to Hillary, who eyed it suspiciously, took a tentative whiff, and slipped it back. "Smells okay." "Damn if it don't taste sour to me." "So Jeannie says you're some kind of environmentalist." "I work for Fish and Wildlife." "Yeah? You like a ranger or something?" "I do environmental impact studies." "That's so. Interesting," lied Franklin. The very word environmental conjured mosquitoes in Franklin's imagination. "I don't wear a uniform or anything like that," Hillary said. "Mostly I just count fish and measure silt levels. We're trying to predict how the landscape will react once the dam is removed." Okay, good. Just making sure. Archie Bunker's in the house, apparently. So Hillary says, "We're trying to predict how the landscape will react once the dam is removed." "Yeah, I heard something about that. Dude on TV said the other day how the dam's on roller skates. That's a fact?" Hillary smiled politely, uncertain whether Franklin was joking. He seemed earnest enough. "That's actually just an expression. It means there's nothing under the dam but alluvial." "Alluvial, huh? You mean like dirt?" "Something like that. More like sand. Some people are afraid the structure will blow out before the restoration even begins." "Inconvenient truth," said Franklin. He had great teeth. Must be all that calcium. Kind of an airhead, though. That she was attracted to Franklin Bell on some level came as a relief to Hillary. Not that she had butterflies. Not that she felt the flush of sexual attraction. Still, there was something there. A sort of magnetism. But then, how could she be certain she wasn't just talking herself into this attraction out of some perverse sense of defiance? Had being called lesbo all these years finally pushed her to the fringes of rural social convention? She liked that Franklin was black. It had to be a character builder in Port Bonita. She smiled inwardly at the thought of Beverly's reaction. Beverly's her mom. "Isn't the truth just generally inconvenient, you said?" she said. Franklin flashed his nice teeth. "Suppose so," he said, sipping his milk. "Before the dam, there were 10 Andromedas fish species in the Elwha," Hillary pursued. "All but one of them is extinct now, and all of it could have been avoided with fish ladders." "Fish ladders, huh? You don't say." Franklin supposed he was still just a city boy deep down. Still a son of Windy City steel and concrete, crowded L trains and noisy storefronts. Because already he had a few questions that he was afraid to ask. For instance, how the hell's a fish supposed to climb a ladder? Also, this is the first he'd heard about fish being transsexual. How was it that after 11 years in Port Bonita, gateway to the Olympic National Wilderness, the mysteries of nature were still foreign to Franklin? Fish run, tree harvest, snowpack, these were just phrases, things to be quite honest he didn't even care to understand. The fact is, he could hardly stand the wilderness. It struck him as lifeless and dull. All those trees just standing around to no purpose. The deafening silence, the mosquitoes. Franklin felt no more at home in the wilderness than a giraffe might feel on the Dan Ryan Expressway. The fact was, he was a little terrified of the wilderness. Given the choice, he'd rather stroll through Cabrini Green waving a fistful of cash at 1 a.m. than walk through Lincoln Park at noon. And yet, not only had he applied for the position in this outpost a decade earlier, he'd even passed up positions in Muncie, Detroit, and Indianapolis, urban locales all, and all of them exponentially closer to Chicago. Only later did it occur to Franklin that he'd been trying to outrun anything. "Any kids?" said Hillary, as though she were reading his mind. "No, nothing like that." "Me neither," she said. "Never got around to it, I guess," said Franklin. "Heck, I can hardly take care of myself." "I know what you mean," said Hillary. In the ensuing silence, Hillary downed her gin and tonic in an effort to soothe her nerves. Franklin followed suit with his milk, grimacing slightly. "Needs rum," he said. After the second gin and tonic, Hillary's nerves settled into a pleasant state of arousal. It felt good being tipsy. Franklin got better by the sip. Maybe he was different than the others. At least he didn't talk about himself the whole time. Hillary felt something bubbling up in her chest that wasn't tonic, as though the evening might be leading somewhere. Franklin was also pleased by the evening's progress. He wasn't forcing anything, like he had with the Longaberger basket rep from Port Townsend or the administrative assistant from the Women's Correctional Facility in Purdy. Franklin was laying back, and everything was smooth sailing until shortly after the third round arrived, when Hillary asked him if he'd done much hiking. "Heck no," he said, waving it off with a grin. "It'd be a cold day in you-know-where before you'd catch me walking around out there. My idea of the great outdoors is a potted plant." Like an anchor chain, disappointment plummeted down the back of Hillary's throat. Franklin could see it and was determined to recover from the misstep. "Of course, I can't say I really ever gave it much a chance. Never cared much for baseball till I saw Wrigley Field. So I guess I could be persuaded to give it a try. Can't really judge a thing till you tried it." It wasn't that Franklin redeemed himself, because, let's face it, this was a deal-breaker. It was more that he tried to redeem himself that kept Hillary from slamming the door on the evening's possibilities. Still, her interest was waning the more he tried to save face, and Franklin could feel it. It was time to push it, he decided. He smiled over the rim of his rum and milk. "Gotta say, blind date and all, I was expecting anyone half as smoking as you." Hillary felt her face color, simultaneously thrilled and annoyed at herself for taking the bait. She had to admit she liked his directness, if nothing else. "Really," pursued Franklin, "usually I wind up with, well, you know, not that I'm Paul Newman or anything, but a fine-looking lady like yourself, girl, you must be beating them off with a stick." Damn it, why did he always start talking like Bobby Brown? Bobby Brown never worked. It was too forward. Always had lewd undertones. But to Franklin's surprise, on this occasion, Bobby Brown worked. If not by way of its intended effect, then simply by its directness. Downing her G&T, Hillary felt the stirrings of an old recklessness. "What now?" she said. Thank you so much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.